Good morning, church. It's great to see y'all this morning. I tell you what, it has been a busy week. If you missed it, last Wednesday night, we had our trunk or treat. We had kids dressed up everywhere and some adults dressed up too. And it was really, really great. The weather got a little miserable outside, but we had amazing company inside. We had our chili cook-off to go with that. And if you have not heard, somebody asked me who the winners were, so I'm going to tell you Shannon Scandura won the best overall chili. Y'all give up for Shannon. The best traditional chili went to Daniela Carroll. There she is. And the People's Choice Award went to Sam Nettable back there somewhere, usually. There he is. So what this tells me is all of our cooking talent has come in the last 2 years. We were so lost without you guys. All the people who won are newer to our congregation, and so that was just a great testimony to our recruiting. really, really good. No, it was great. And then last night we had the hayride out at the Parkers, which was fantastic. The hayride went perfect as usual, and every year it just goes so smooth. And but we had a lot of great food. We sat around campfires and stoves and had a big time. It's always a great thing. So thankful that it's just tough to beat those times when you get to have good food and good company and good times. That's just the best to me, isn't it? How many of you have ever heard of a lady? Her name is Laura McCallum. You may not have heard of her. I hadn't heard about her, but I read a little bit about her this week. She had a pretty good life. She had an MBA from prestigious Boston College, really good business school, and she worked for years in advertising and public relations. She managed several million-dollar accounts. So she said it was kind of madman-esque, not quite that long ago, but it was just a kind of a wild life. And she said that her excesses were not just tolerated, but they were normalized. She said that liquid lunches were normalized, and drinking at your desk late in the afternoon was perfectly normal. That was just the lifestyle. So she had this the exact fun, successful lifestyle that made her the envy of a lot of people in our culture. She was, in a lot of ways, we would say she's living the dream, right? She's got a fun job. She's with fun people. She's doing fun things. She's making a lot of money doing it. I mean, it's perfect. So it wasn't until she woke up in a jail cell with a DUI over a holiday weekend, so she had an extended stay. It wasn't until that moment that she started paying attention that her drinking was threatening her relationship with her daughter. It already cost her marriage, but she was willing to let that go. It cost her relationship with a daughter. She realized she was spending most of her time covering up and carrying around big secrets. It was ruining her life. And that was her beginning path to sobriety. So now she's a really successful author and speaker and recovery advocate who writes and speaks about authentic living and sobriety. And so here we are. We're a long ways from where she lived and a long ways from that life. But sitting here in a church auditorium, I tell you that story, and you're like, well, that's not shocking at all, right? It probably doesn't surprise anyone here that good living is not found in an alcohol-fueled lifestyle. I don't think that's earth-shattering news to anybody here. It might be to some in our community, but for most of you who are here, that's what you would expect to hear. But the truth is that most of our world does not know what a good life is. If you were to go out to the average person in Manchester or Coffee County or McMinnville or anywhere around here, and you just say, what is a good lifestyle? And you ask them to give you a description of what is a good life, you would give just so many different answers. right? Some people would say it's being famous. Some people would think, no, I don't want to be famous, but I want to be rich. Some people would say it's being married to a person who looks a certain way or acts a certain way or living in a house that looks a certain way or having a job that does this for me. There's a whole bunch of different ideas about what is a good life. And even if many of us this morning may feel like we know, it may feel like we're finding out by sort of wandering around in the dark, like the things we've discovered about life have been like when you play games as children, you're trying to figure out what's what with your eyes closed. And that's how we found out what a good life looks like. We've sort of stumbled upon it and put a few nicks in our shins along the way. But we're not the first people to grapple with this question. In the Gospel of Mark, someone finally asks Jesus about it, about what's really important in life. Now, remember where we are in the Gospel of Mark. We're getting towards the end here. He's already come into Jerusalem. He has cleared the temple, and he has been sparring back and forth with these religious leaders and teachers and elders and Pharisees and Sadducees. And so they keep coming to him with questions about his authority and his identity and all those sorts of things. And just when you think that, that all of that is over, all this questioning is over, there is one last scribe. One last teacher of the law who comes to ask one last question. Now remember, Jesus has sort of outsmarted everyone at each step along the way. Every time they ask him a question, he asks them a better question back. That's sort of the way Jesus operates. He's outmaneuvered them at every turn. So they're trying to find something to pin him down on. They don't like him. They're trying to show what a fraud he is, how he's not worthy of being followed. That's their goal in general. And Jesus just keeps outsmarting them at in every public forum. So they're trying to pin him down or charge him or find fault with him, but they cannot do it. So here we are with one last effort. It's going to be the last or the final question of Jesus, but it doesn't go the way you might expect. So here's what happens in Mark chapter 12. It says, one of the teachers of the law came and heard them debating, Jesus and these other religious leaders, right? And noticing that Jesus had given them a good answer, he asked them, of all the commandments, which is the most important? Okay, we're hearing this question or we're reading this question and we're thinking, oh, he's come with a Bible question. It would be like if I came to you and said, what's your favorite Bible story? And you would say, oh, I love the story of Jonah and the whale, or I love the story of David and Goliath, or whatever your favorite story is. That's what this question sort of looks like to us. To Jesus, to the person who's asking it, to the other people who are around them, this is not a Bible question. This is not a trivia question. This was a question about what is the center of life. Really, that's what he's asking him. If I'm going to build my life around a core principle, what should it be? I mean, there are hundreds of laws. We'll talk about those in just a little bit. And people debated this question all the time. And they were like, no, this is the right one. This is the right one. They had all these different ideas. Which one do you build your life around? You can't do them all. You have to start somewhere and build outward from that. So by asking which commandment is the most important, what he's really asking is, how do I live a successful life, a good life? The same question we're wrestling with this morning. And this is how Jesus answers him. The most important one, answered Jesus, is this. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. Love the Lord your God with all of your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. The second is this. Love your neighbor as yourself. There is no commandment greater than these. So there's Jesus' reply. You're probably familiar with it. Maybe heard about it, sung about it, something along those lines. How is this teacher of the law going to catch Jesus now? Well said, teacher, the man replied. You are right in saying that God is one and there's no other but Him. To love Him with all your heart, with all your understanding, and with all your strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself is more important than all burnt offerings and sacrifices. When Jesus saw that he had answered wisely, he said, "You are not far from the kingdom of God." And from then on, no one dared ask him any more questions. Now again, this is not the first time Jesus has been questioned by the scribe. But all of those other questions have been like delegations. Like, we're going to send out you guys. All right, come here. Huddle up, guys. Huddle up. I want y'all to go find out what he thinks about the resurrection. All right, ready? Go. Send him out there. Pin him down. Make him look bad in front of the people. I want you guys. Everybody has a different tactic, right? This doesn't seem to be that. He is not sent. He is not a delegation. He's just a guy. He's just a guy coming to Jesus with, I believe, a sincere question. This individual, he sees that Jesus has been giving, like, not just, it says, a good answer. It's not just that Jesus is clever. That's not what he's saying. Well, just Jesus is a smart cookie. He's not just saying that. He's saying that his answers are good, that they're wholesome, they're satisfying, that they've been life-giving. Jesus' answers have been insightful and life-giving. And so this leads this scribe to hope that maybe Jesus is not like everybody else who stands up here and gives answers. I want to ask this guy the most important question. And the question, of course, that he asked Jesus was often debated. It was frequently debated among the different rabbis. So the Torah, the law, has anybody know how many commandments are contained in the Torah? There's an actual number. 613. There are 613 commandments. I mean, it looks, if you think about it, it's kind of like our tax code. It feels like to us, you know, which tax law is the most important tax law? It can get confusing because there's so many and there's so many good ones. Not tax laws, they're all bad. But which commandment is a really good commandment, right? And so they debated this question all the time. So it's natural for them to discuss which one would be the most important or heavier. They would say it's heavier than the others. Now, nobody would say that the others are unimportant. Nobody would say, well, just pay attention to this one and don't worry about the rest. Nobody would say that. Nobody would say that anything was unimportant, but just that some were more important. They were looking for what was most, like, fundamental. What's the starting place? The commandment on which all the other commandments are based on. And so Jesus answers this question by pointing to what's called the Shema. Now, that's a Hebrew word. You now know Hebrew. The word Shema comes from, by the way, this passage comes from Deuteronomy 6, 4 through 5. It was a passage that was built into the very fabric of Jewish life. Everybody said this twice a day. And so the reason it's called Shema, that Hebrew word, it's the word listen or hear. So the very first word is Shema. It was written down on little scrolls. You put it conspicuously on your door frame. This was like, it was foundational for Jewish life to say, love the Lord your God with all your heart, with all your soul, with all your mind, with all your strength. It was repeated twice a day at morning and evening by all God-fearing Jews. So here is the Shema. It comes out of Deuteronomy chapter 6, verses 4 through 5. Now, when he says this, all your heart and soul, and sometimes it includes mind, or strength or might, that encompasses kind of everything. It's like your thinking, your feelings, your desires, your understanding, your energy, your power. In other words, this is like your whole life. your whole life, everything that makes you you, everything that sums up making us human beings, it is you and all that you do. Everything about you should be wrapped up in loving God. And then Jesus follows up with the bonus answer. It's another commandment. Love your neighbor as yourself. He's quoting there from Leviticus chapter 19, verses 18, when God's handing out these commandments, and he says, you know, don't go around seeking revenge or bearing a grudge against among your people, but love your neighbor as yourself. And Jesus says that's the second most important thing. And it's only the first thing. Like if you reversed these, it wouldn't work. If you said this was the most important commandment and loving God was the second most important commandment, it doesn't work. You can't get a love for God out of loving other people. But you can get a love for other people out of loving God. And if you take them apart, like if you disconnect them, and you say, well, just focus on loving God, then what you end up with is someone who looks down their nose at everyone who doesn't do it right. And maybe you've met those people, the people who are so focused on getting it all right and them getting it all right with God, they're just going to love God and forget the rest of y'all. And there's a lot of, can be some condescension and some alienation from everybody else. If you get people who just focus on loving their neighbor, on the other hand, and don't focus on loving God, then what you get is just kind of good humanitarianism that is divorced from reality and meaning. In other words, it's all about being kind and being good regardless of the ramifications without ever thinking about the long-term effects. So this love of God and love of neighbor, sometimes we hear that and we think about it, it's about a feeling, like I love my kids, or I love my wife, or I love my job, or I love Moose Tracks ice cream because it is the best, right? We think it's about a feeling, but that's not what's really being communicated here. Love of God is about obedience of God. You cannot love God and not obey God. Impossible. To use love the way the Bible is using love here, love connotes obedience. It connotes action. You cannot divorce love and obedience. Those have to be together. Love is more important than a religious ritual. It is bigger than that. And love apart from obedience is meaningless. It doesn't do anything. This obedience to God, contrary to what some people think, it's not about making sure you have every I dotted and every T crossed so that we're worthy to enter in God's presence. That is not what this loving God is about. It is an obedience that comes from a heart that has experienced God's amazing grace and been transformed by it. It is not the love of someone with a doctorate who just loves the institution they work for. It is the love of a child whose parent cares for their every need. That's the sort of love we're talking about. For a kid, their parent is their whole world, right? I mean, a parent doesn't even have to be a good parent. The parent is still the whole world. A child just knows that without them, they're sort of lost, untethered. Abandoned. And when God says to love him, he's asking for us to love that even though it's not perfect and we do it wrong and we're going to disobey sometimes or we're going to mess up, that's okay. Just love God that way, that trusting way with all of our heart, soul, mind, and strength. It's loving God like a person and loving other people as if they belong to God because they do. So when the scribe hears Jesus' answer, he knows, deep down he knows that Jesus is right. This is it. This is life. There's something about this teacher that cannot be tripped up or tricked or pinned down or made to look bad or discredited, that there's something about Jesus that cannot be written off. He is not someone we need to get rid of. He's someone we need to cling hold of. But that's exactly what we're tempted to do, isn't it? It is really tempting to think that loving God is just maybe church talk. Like if I tell you, you need to love God, it's just something you say at church or in a Bible class or in a conversation with a spiritual friend, just Bible talk, that it's sort of divorced from real living, that loving God doesn't have anything to do with what you're going to do when you leave here and go home and go to work or whatever it is you do through the week, that loving God doesn't have anything to do with that. Real life, if we were to describe and ask everybody what's real life, we would say maybe it's a successful job or it's money in the bank. Real life is power and influence and maybe even fame. It's the things that you have to work through all the troubles you experience. That's what real life is. Like, you can't throw anything at that guy he can't get through. He's got a good education. He's got a good support system. He's got plenty of money. He's got good health or whatever, right? Whatever we think you have to get through the problems of life, that's the good life. That's what we want. In 2005, Tom Brady was interviewed. And this is young Tom Brady, right? This was pre-supermodel wife, which, how tragic. And but he's like Super Bowl rings already. In fact, he's in his late 20s here, already had 3 Super Bowl rings, really a successful career. He gets interviewed. This is a 60-minute interview. The interviewer is a guy named Steve Croft. And this is what Tom Brady said. Says, why do I have 3 Super Bowl rings and still think there's something greater out there for me? I mean, maybe a lot of people would say, hey, man, this is what it is. You've reached your goal, your dream, your life. Me? I think, God, it's got to be more than this. I mean, this can't be all that it's cracked up to be. So Steve Croft asked him, he said, what's the answer? And Tom Brady said, I wish I knew. I wish I knew. Well, this morning, here we are, and you probably don't have Super Bowl rings or more money than you can spend. You probably aren't famous all over the world for being the best ever at your job. But this morning, you have something he does not. You have the answer to that question. Or you're being offered that answer. I can't make you take it. Nobody can make you take it. But you're being offered the answer to that question. The life, the real life that is offered by the Creator, the one who made life. That life that we can only get by learning to live in and through and to truly love God. So that, again, it sounds like church talk, sounds like Bible talk. What does that mean when I say you need to love God? Because I want you to have something when you leave here that you're like, I want to love God more. I know I don't love God enough. I want to love God more. I know my life is not as good or as much or as deep or as powerful, as real as what is being talked about there. What can I do? And I will tell you that if you want to love God, here is one thing you have to do. And I'm just going to tell you one thing. So this is the one thing you can do this week if you want to love God. Because in a lot of ways, a relationship with God is not any different than a relationship with a person. It's got some similarities there. The only way that you can truly love anyone is to spend time with them. That's got to be it. That's the foundation. The same is true of any relationship you're ever going to have. And the same is true in our relationship with God. So spend time with God. How do you do that? Talk to Him. Listen to Him. Think about Him. Obey Him. Like, do what he says. All that means, and this is not revelatory. I am not reinventing the wheel this morning. I'm not going to tell you something you've never heard before. I'm going to tell you what you probably already know, that you need to spend some time in prayer. And I'm not talking about you've got to go up like Jesus on the side of a mountain and pray all night long. Maybe you can do that, but maybe you've got to get up in the morning and go to work. So what about 5 minutes before you go to work? Or 5 minutes after you get off work while you're sitting in your car before you come home? Or 5 minutes when you lay your head down before you go to sleep? Just talk to him and listen to him. Spend some time in God's word. I had somebody ask me this morning, should I be reading? And that's a good question. There's a lot, the Bible's all pretty good. So it's tough to, when somebody asks me, I'm like, oh man, that's a lot of good stuff. I want you to be reading. If you're just looking to know something about the character of God, read the book of Psalms. I'll just give you, this is just me to you. Just read the book of Psalms, because it's conversations with God, and that's what you're trying to do. You get to know a little bit about God, and you understand sometimes what the guy who's writing it is going through. So listen to him as well. Meditate on what he says. Like, think about it. Don't just, sometimes this is the mistake we make as Christians. When I say read the Bible, you think, okay, I'm going to read the book of Matthew. That's a good one that talks about Jesus. So Monday, Matthew chapter 1. All right, Matthew chapter 1. Done. Tuesday, Matthew chapter 2. That's the noise you make when you read. And done. Matthew chapter 2. Put that away. And so you think, like, just consuming, I did it. I read that part, and that's good. That is not what I'm talking about. You may just read one verse. You may need two or three or four or five. I don't know, but it's not about getting through anything. It is about getting that one thing and taking that in and digesting it. Sometimes we take in scripture like Cookie Monster takes in cookies. And we're like, just dump the whole box and chew up and everything falls out, right? But I got it. I did it. I crunched it all up, but I never actually digested it. So just read a few verses that until you get to something you're like, oh, wow, that's powerful. Then stop right there. Take that and pray about that one thing. And what is this saying to you? And what do you need to talk to God about that? And then listen to it and think about it through that day. And you can do that while you are at work or while you are driving or while you're at the dinner table. You can have a conversation about that if you're fortunate enough to be married to a Christian spouse or have parents or Christians or parents or kids who are Christians. You can have those conversations. What a blessing that is. So just meditate on it. Think about it. How does this change my life? What is this saying to me that I need to do differently? Or what should I stop doing? Or what should I start thinking about myself or thinking about Jesus or thinking about God? So listen to him, talk to him, meditate on him, and to just do it. And we talked about this in my Bible class this morning. You're not going to do it well. Well, maybe you are. I don't. When I start doing something new, I don't start doing it well. It takes me some practice. So I'm going to, on behalf of the Forest Mill Church of Christ, I would like to formally extend to you permission to fail. You get to mess up. It's on the house. You get to try and be more like Jesus. You get to try and grow closer to God and get it wrong sometimes. That's okay. Because even your failures are better than your nothings. So my prayer for you this morning, my prayer for us as a congregation this morning, is that we will spend time with God, learn to love God. It may not come naturally. Learn to love God so that we can learn to love one another. And that is how God changes the world. This morning, if we can lift you up, encourage you, give you prayers for strength or forgiveness or for new life, if you're ready to put on Jesus Christ in baptism, have your old life and your sins washed away and put on Jesus Christ to begin this new life. Whatever we can do for you this morning, won't you come now while we stand and while we sing?